This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, Chinese blogger, and I used to be indecisive, but now I'm not so sure. My co-host is John Pasden, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and has always said sign language is the least spoken language in the world. What's in a name? In this episode, John and I deconstruct names in Chinese and recommend on how to pick a good one for you. Guest interview is with Millie Potter, who during a study abroad in China, took the path less traveled and forged her own way through her university's program. Listen to her cultural insights and how she made a breakthrough in learning Chinese. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah.
Hey, I am John Pasden. I am in Shanghai, China.
John, it is my favorite time of the year. Spring is here, at least in the USA. I hope it's pretty good over there in Shanghai.
Pretty good. It's a nice time of year, but maybe not the best year for spring.
Yeah, well, yes. Quarantine's keeping everyone home. Well, at least you can get a nice look outside your window, hopefully.
Yeah, I guess.
Okay, guys. Well, to kick things off, we have some reviews. We've got three reviews to read. We've been getting some emails with reviews in them, and I realized we haven't been reading those on the air. So John is reading one of those today. But the first review I have for you is Mitchell Mimingqiu. He's from United States, and he says, "My favorite podcast, no other one like it. I've been listening to the podcast since episode one. I'm a white guy from LA who's been studying Mandarin for about 5 years now. I love the show so much. There really isn't another one like it." Well, okay, fine. "The interviews are always fun and informative. The advice given is insightful. Mm-hmm. Hearing from people who've been through the grind and achieve fluency is so valuable. When I was in China back in July of 2019 on a Sunday, I remember getting a notification that the podcast dropped. I was so thrilled because it normally comes out on Mondays. It was like a gift. So I listened to it while I was at Shanghai Disneyland by myself. Also, when I was back in China in December 2019, Jared or John recommended people to go try China-exclusive toffee Starbucks drink. I ordered one the same day and drank several more after that. Ha ha. Keep it up, guys. Also, Jared's intro sequence dad jokes make me laugh every time." Well, what can I say, John?
High praise. That was me recommending the toffee nut latte.
And you know, that's awesome. I don't know if, John, if you remember that day where you just felt like you were at Disneyland. I think it's because he was listening to us while he was going on rides and stuff.
It was a good day.
It was a good day.
Okay, thank you. So next we have a review from Helen in Austin, Texas. And she says, "I really love this podcast. In the beginning, I really thought it was a similar podcast to Chinese Pod or Chinese Class 101 and will teach you Chinese, and I'm glad it wasn't. You see, I actually did learn Chinese for about 2 years already, and I gave up due to lack of resources that are my level. I tried looking for easy reading materials, but only found super advanced materials, and looking up everything in the dictionary 80% of the time really made me lose interest. Hearing your podcast with all the guests and hearing about their own struggles, similar to my own, and how they worked through it, really motivated me to pick up Chinese again. And so I did after about 8 episodes. I'm caught up now to all 31 episodes. Yay! I've learned many new tricks, such as putting in little sticky notes with the name of things and characters all over my home, as mentioned in episode 6 to get a mini immersion feel, to learn Chinese, and found more resources from listening to your podcast. And I'm grateful that you provided links to those resources in your show notes. They really help. Even the rants and raves really help too, in showing which resources are good and bad." All right. Well, Helen, we're really glad we're helping you. It's cool.
All right, we have our last review to read, and this is from Sean T. 2017. And he's from Great Britain. He says, "Great podcast. Inspiring, motivating, and informative." All right, Sean. Thanks, man. We like it. To the point. Sweet and simple.
Thanks, man.
All right, guys. So occasionally we get some emails from our listeners, and we've gotten a few emails recently, and two of them we felt like we could answer together. Okay, the first one is from Kieran Omiri. I think that's how we pronounce her name, so bear with me. Sorry, Kieran, if we said your name wrong. She says, "What books would you recommend for someone who's struggling with basic Mandarin and loves reading? She said she worked in Shanghai for 3 months back in 2011, and she'd been learning Mandarin on and off since then. It has only passed HSK1 exam last year. But she says, I have to be honest, it is not my highest priority. It's very much nice to have, but I would like to get to HSK3 over the next 2 years. I'm Irish and I live outside of Ireland, so keeping up my Irish and trying to learn German are higher priorities." And John, you want to read the other one?
Hi, Jared. How can I learn Mandarin having available 2 hours per week, including practice and homework? Or is this impossible and I should give up? I'd like to be able to communicate verbally rather than learn characters, which are difficult. I have tried several times, but no luck. Any suggestions?
And that was Enrique. All right. So thanks for the emails, guys. We really appreciate it. And we want to kind of hit both of these up because I think a lot of listeners can relate to this, is that, hey, you want to learn Chinese, but you just don't have a lot of time, or you have a lot of other things that are going on in your life right now. This is super common. And here's what I will say, guys, is that if you want to learn Chinese, you're probably not going to make a lot of progress if you're only putting in occasional time or even 2 hours a week. Will you make progress? Yeah, especially if you're starting at a very low level, you can make progress. But putting in that like kind of casual or just like a very little time a week, that can help you maintain your Chinese to a level that you've achieved, but it's probably not going to be enough to really start making progress.
Yeah, I think what people often don't really understand is that to keep improving your Chinese, you have to make sure you're putting in enough time. And the lower the level, the less time you need to invest to make improvement. So if you know no Chinese, then putting in an hour a week is going to see good results. But before too long, once you get to elementary, an hour a week is going to see, you know, less and less improvement for that investment. And so, you know, if you want to get to intermediate, then an hour a week probably is not going to be enough. It's okay if you only have an hour a week for Chinese, but you have to recognize that that's not going to get you to fluency.
A good frame of reference that I'd like to bring up here is what the United States State Department puts out regarding foreign language training. They put their foreign service officers through language training when they go on assignment to other countries. And they put Chinese, it's in one of their, that's in the highest category of difficulty for English speakers. And they say, on average, for someone to get to a working proficiency in Chinese, it takes 2,200 class hours. John, I don't exactly like that number either. There's no real hard number on it. And that's not to say after that, you're like fluent, or you can be conversational way before that. But if you look at that, just even doing the math, 2,200 class hours, and you're putting in 2 hours a week, and you're staying consistent on that, what you're getting up to 104 hours in a year. And so at that rate, if this does hold true, you should be able to get to working proficiency in roughly 22 years.
Well, the other thing is, the more you stretch it out, then the more hours it's going to take, because that's not a hard and fast number that it's going to be true for everybody. It's a rough estimate, right? And also, the more you compress those hours, you know, you're doing 6 hours a day or something, the more you compress them, then probably the fewer it's going to take, because you're going to be able to retain it and you'll be able to absorb the language faster, like in an immersion learning experience. Yeah, there are a lot of factors here, guys. The numbers are not going to be the same for everybody. Everyone has a different situation, different strengths and weaknesses. It's hard to say, but one thing that is for sure, the more time you put in, the faster your progress is going to be, and you're going to be able to maintain that progress.
Absolutely. This reminds me, John, of one of the academics in extensive reading. What he usually says, he says, what's the most important thing to study? What you learned yesterday. That highlights this here, is that you're studying occasionally or just, you know, 2 hours a week, you know, maybe 1 hour here and then 1 hour there. You are going to forget a lot in between those lessons and between that time you're actually putting in. So daily consistent effort, or, you know, even daily, I think 15, 20 minutes a day will get you a little further than probably just doing a half hour here, a half hour there, an hour there.
Yeah, for sure. Regular review, regular study is the way to go. So distribute that time if you can. But getting back to one of the questions, they said, you know, what books would you recommend if I'm really struggling with basic Mandarin? So we have our breakthrough level books, which are 150 characters. But if even that is too much, there's also a series of books by Terry Waltz. You remember Terry? Jared, we met her at one of those conferences, Axful.
Yeah, Terry's great.
Yeah, so Waltz, W-L-T-Z, Terry Waltz. She has some good materials that are lower level than what we do. So you should check those out.
Yeah, I think she has one of her books that only uses like 37 or 38 characters. So like, you're way beginner. Like, learn those characters and start trying to read.
Good luck. All right, so now we're going to get into today's main topic, which is all about how to pick a Chinese name. This is a topic I've dealt with a lot over the years. I have a lot of ideas. Obviously, Jared will have plenty to say as well.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions we should start with is, do you even need a Chinese name? I think that's a good question. What do you think, Jared?
Well, I think it depends. Like, if you are going to be living in China and you're going to be around a lot of native Chinese people, even people that don't speak Chinese, it helps.
Although sometimes they're happy to use your English name, so it might not be necessary at all. For some formal documents in China, like work permits,
In fact, John, I was filing away some of my documents just this weekend, and I opened up my old Chinese work permit, and boom, there it was. There's my Chinese name, and I'm like, oh yeah, you do. You have to have a Chinese name for a Chinese work permit.
And if you don't have one, then they'll give you one. And that's just like transliterating. So just taking the sounds of your name and trying to convert it to Chinese. So it's going to be really long and ugly sounding.
Like, do they have people that just sit around and do that?
I think maybe it could even be automated. I don't know. Because it's not pretty. It's not a good result.
No, it's not.
But on my thoughts of why you might need a Chinese name, one place I found it was useful is if you talk to old people. So in my case, my in-laws are Chinese. And they know my English name, but they definitely prefer to use my Chinese name. They're just not used to saying English, and they struggle with it a little bit. But my wife, pretty much, you know, all my employees, all my Chinese friends, they pretty much all call me by my English name because, you know, John is pretty easy. And I don't know, we both feel like it's my name, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's so true. You know, I've worked in a number of companies in China, and it is kind of interesting that most people did call me by my English name, Jared. But yeah, I did have a lot of people who like to use my Chinese name. It's like a little bit more endearing. It's kind of thing like this. If you've had a Chinese person from, you know, at school or at work, and maybe they had a Chinese name that was easy to pronounce, but sometimes, like, I remember before I even started learning Chinese, you know, like, seemed like, you know, Xiong or something, and, you know, those XI, I'm like, whoa, that's confusing. I don't even know how to say the guy's name. And in fact, I did know a guy. He picked out the name Elmer. All right. So, well, it was a unique name in English, right? But hey, he picked out a name, and it was a lot easier for me to call him that name. It's going to be the same thing when you flip it the other way.
Yeah, especially if your name is not one of those easy to pronounce names, like if you're not a John or a Jared. Some Chinese people might really struggle with your name, and they'll be grateful that you have a Chinese name.
So, John, tell us then, like, what kind of name should someone be going for? And like, how do you actually go through the process of picking one out?
Okay, so I actually recently wrote an article on this, and I see kind of four different approaches to take for choosing a Chinese name. They can overlap. And the first one is the one that I already mentioned. That's the transliteration one, where you just take the English name and you take every syllable and you do your best to convert it into something Chinese. Beethoven would be Beidofen, and Einstein would be Einstein. It doesn't sound Chinese. Sometimes it sounds terrible, but it's Chinese characters, and it's recognizably a foreign name. So not only is it Chinese, but you're kind of tagging it with this is a foreigner's name type label.
One I always like that I think some of our listeners who've read our books, they might know is Sherlock Holmes, right? It's a Fu-er-mo-si. That's like a mouthful.
Yeah, it doesn't sound too much like Holmes to us, but that's the Chinese transliteration. Okay, so these names sound totally foreign. They're usually not what you're thinking of when you're talking about choosing a Chinese name. For me, the Chinese transliteration of John, the traditional one, is Yue Han, which comes from Johann, I guess, like German or something. Anyway, I didn't like it. It doesn't sound like a Chinese name. I definitely did not take this approach, but it's what you get if you don't choose one yourself and you have to have a Chinese name.
So this is good for people to know if you ever travel to China or you go to some, you know, Chinese market and they're like, oh, you know, we'll make a little seal with your name in Chinese on it. Pretty much what they're doing is they're just going to transliterate your name. Or heaven forbid, you get a tattoo. You know, like, oh, this is yeah. My name in Chinese. Oh, really?
Yeah, a good clue is when it's 10 characters long. You know, most Chinese names should be two or three characters, but a transliterated name is usually going to be 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, pretty long.
Or worse.
Yeah, okay. Let's put that one aside. We're probably not going to use that method to choose a Chinese name. Now, another method is to choose a Chinese nickname. So this is not like the standard Chinese surname plus one or two characters for the given name. It's not that. It's a name. It's Chinese. It's maybe cute. It wouldn't work on like a Chinese person's legal documents, but Chinese people might like it. It might be funny. I know a lot of foreigners who have done it this way. There's actually a really famous one. He's a Canadian named Da Shan. He was super popular in China when I first got here 20 years ago, but he's quite well known to this day.
Mark Roswell.
Yes. Now, Da is not a surname, right? So Da Shan is just a nickname. It's actually the name of a character he played when he first started acting on Chinese TV.
Yeah, by the way, this guy Da Shan, or Mark Roswell, his Chinese is amazing. It was so good, he did these comedy routines on Chinese TV, and so he became very popular.
Yep. So another good example of this, which doesn't totally follow under the category of could not possibly be a name, but Jeremy Goldcorn, one of the editors for previously Danwei.org and now SubChina. His Chinese name is Jin Yumi, which literally means gold corn. It's pretty funny. Jin is actually a Chinese surname. So legally, you could use this as a Chinese name. And sometimes Chinese people have weird names. So I think it would be hard to convince people that that's a real Chinese name, but I don't know, maybe.
Another nickname I see frequently in China, something these foreigners, maybe they don't really speak a lot of Chinese, or I don't know, they have that, they got this nickname, and it's Dalong, which it means big dragon. I've also seen Xiaolong, which Xiaolong, is John, right, is Bruce Lee's nickname in Chinese.
Right. I think that's just his name.
Li Xiaolong. Okay, there you go. See, Bruce, little dragon, I don't know.
Okay, now the thing about these nicknames is that it's pretty hard to choose them for yourself. So you'll want a Chinese person helping you with this. But if you can find a good one, you know, your friends maybe can think of a good nickname that's really well suited to you. It can be a lot of fun. And Chinese people might really enjoy calling you that. Okay, so next, we're getting closer and closer to like a real authentic Chinese name. I'm not sure what to call it, like a familiar name. Like in China, you have mostly one character surnames, you know, like Ma or Pan, something like that. And then you can put this Xiao in front of it to indicate that they're young, or you put a Lao in front of it to indicate that they're senior to you. So you can have like a Lao Ma, Xiao Pan. And this is what Chinese people actually call themselves. Like that's frequently what they call their coworkers. They use this Xiao or this Lao prefix and then just the surname. So it's not a full name. Like you wouldn't have that on your passport or your, you know, your ID, but it's totally how people call each other. And that could be just kind of your only Chinese name.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot in the workplace that happens. So like someone calling you Old Pasden or Little Pasden, right? Or same to me, like Old Turner. But yeah, it's totally normal. You know, it's a little more familiar, right?
Yeah, and it's very authentic. It's just not a full name. Like this is actually how I started out with my Chinese name. So my last name is Pasden, P-A-S-D-E-N, and I wanted to condense it into a single character. So I got Pan, first home, P-A-N. And I knew I wanted that surname because I felt like it was a good representation of my real surname. So for a while, I just went by Xiao Pan. Chinese people thought this was funny. At the time, I was young, you know, I was like 22, but I was really tall, you know, like I am now. And so they thought it was kind of funny calling a foreigner, big, tall foreigner, Xiao Pan. So that's how I started.
You know, one thing I found was sometimes people use the Lao even like as a term of respect. Like I remember I was once on this, working on this project with these guys and I was kind of directing it. I was kind of like I was the guy they hired to come in to work on things. But this guy who was older than me, he was calling me Lao Tang because my Chinese last name, my Chinese family name is Tang, you know, Turner, Tang is pretty close. So he would call me Lao Tang, and I felt really weird to me because this guy was like 10 years older than me, but he was trying to like, you know, give me a little respect, like revering, you know, like, oh, you know, you're the knowledgeable one, or, you know, you're the one helping us.
Maybe he just thought you looked really old, dude.
Evidently.
No, that's totally true. Lao is a way to be respectful. You're never calling someone old when you put Lao in front of their surname. It is kind of weird, like something is up when they're clearly younger than you and you're using Lao. Could also be a joke.
And on the flip side, you wouldn't call someone who's senior to you Xiao. Like you wouldn't, if the guy was like your boss, you know, he's like 50-year-old boss guy, you wouldn't say Xiao Li.
Yeah, it would be kind of flippant or rude. It's like you don't refer to your boss as dude. You know, what's up, dude? Like it's just not appropriate if it's the type of boss that demands respect. So finally, let's get to the final type, which is like trying to sound like a Chinese name. So a lot of foreigners would like a Chinese name, which is essentially indistinguishable from what a Chinese person would have. They want something that's legit, right? They want something where if they stick it on a Chinese resume or something, Chinese people don't immediately know that you're not Chinese. So if you're going to do that, that's cool, but you're definitely going to want to get help from Chinese people.
Oh, yes. This is something you just can't do by yourself. And I will say this is like, you know how sometimes someone might choose their own English name? Let's put it this way. I remember once, was it the first place I worked in Shanghai? This one girl, she came up to me. I was new in the office. She says, oh, hi, you know, you're the new guy. You know, your assistant's a good friend of mine. I'm like, great, what's your name? She says, my name's Radiohead. Can you guess why my name's Radiohead? I'm like, oh, gee, tell me. She's like, because I really like Radiohead. So if you try to pick out your own Chinese name, you might end up with something like that.
Okay, so you definitely need help from native Chinese speakers for choosing a Chinese name that sounds like a Chinese person's name. But not only that, I really want to stress, that you cannot trust any single person. Like, everyone has their own subjective opinions. And one person is going to be like, this is the absolute best name for you. Stop asking people. This is it. And then everyone else is going to be like, what? That's totally a girl's name. Do you want a girl's name? You know, like, you got to be careful. You got to ask a lot of people, ideally.
And also, in Chinese, your names all have meaning. Like, think about this for a second. Have you ever had a Chinese person, you tell them, you say, what's your name? And you tell them your name. Like, what does your name mean? And for most of us in the English-speaking world, and I imagine for many listeners, too, if your English isn't your native language, you maybe don't even know what the meaning of your name is. Like, Jared, I don't actually remember. I've looked it up before, but I don't remember what Jared means. But you see, Chinese is totally different. I mean, because, you know, you're working with about 5,000 characters. And so every character has a meaning. And so people are very careful on how they're selecting their characters for their kids and, you know, what names they're giving to it, because they want to give it a good meaning. So it's got to sound right. It's got to sound good altogether. And it also has to have meaning.
John means gift of God, by the way.
Of course you are, John.
I want to make a little exception to that. Like, for the most part, yeah. But if your name is transliterated, the ones that get automatically generated, like, according to sound, the characters that you get from that are essentially meaningless, and people understand that they're meaningless. But if you're choosing names that sound like Chinese people's names, it's like 2 or 3 characters total, then yeah, each character is important. So if you're trying to come up with a Chinese name, there's basically 2 different approaches that you want to use, and you might use some kind of mix in between them. And they are, 1, go for something that sounds similar, and then the opposite end is go for something that means what you want it to mean. So I know people who want a name that sounds as close as possible to their English name, either their full name or just their last name or just their full name. And then I know people that don't care at all about how it sounds. They just want it to have a certain meaning because they think that's cool. And then I know people who have kind of accomplished a hybrid somewhere in between. It sounds kind of like their name and it has a certain meaning that they like.
So John, let's talk about your Chinese name. What is your Chinese name and what does it mean?
So my Chinese name is Pan Ji. So I already mentioned that Pan is kind of the condensed form of my surname, Pasden. And then Ji is J-I. It just begins with a J, like John. It means good fortune. And it's not an uncommon character. It means good luck. I kind of chose this name because it's similar to John in that it's not uncommon. It's simple. It's short. I also like that it was easy to write. I wasn't going for something like mystical and like super cool. I just wanted something that was kind of simple, kind of would sit well with the common people. Everyone knows how to write it. So that's how I got my name.
And so if your name happens to be Pangea, then you could probably just go for Panji, right?
Well, you would add an A on the end probably, right?
Pangea. And you're a massive landmass.
What about your name, Jared?
All right, my Chinese name is Tang Wei Jie. Now, this name, I didn't pick it out. When I came to Shanghai, I was only there for like a few weeks, and I was working with a startup company, and one of the girls there, she was like, you guys need Chinese names. It was me and a couple of the other foreigners. And so she had gotten to know us for a couple of weeks, and then she picked out names for all of us. And so she's like, there, this is a great Chinese name. And honestly, as I've used it throughout my time in China, Chinese people are like, that's a great name. So Tang is the Tang Dynasty, the Tang. And Wei means big or great. And Jie is like outstanding. It's like a hero. It's like a person. Someone's, you know, prominent. So Wei Jie is like big, outstanding. So it can be a little pretentious but I tell people, like, I didn't pick it out. I have run across some people, though, you know, some Chinese people who actually had that name. Tang Wei Jie.
Yeah, actually, both of those characters are common in male names. And most characters are not, like, forbidden for one gender or the other, but you'll find that certain characters appear over and over again in people's names, and those tend to be the safe ones. And then certain characters never appear in names. And if you suggest it, you know, you're going to get shot down. But there's no real way of knowing what those characters are unless you've done a ton of research. It's also very useful to just look at a whole bunch of Chinese names. You know, get a list, like, you know, credits for a movie or something. Start looking up the characters and, you know, get some inspiration that way.
But I think a good thing to point out here is that you as a non-native speaker will not be able to pick this out by yourself, and you won't know what sounds good. And I learned this from you, John. because I remember when I was trying to come up with a Chinese name for my company, right? And I thought I had a good name, and you're like, and you're generally like, yeah, it could be good, but I'm like, well, does it sound good? And you're like, I don't know, I have no clue. You're like, you got to ask a native speaker. And I'm like, John, you are the closest thing to a native speaker, you know, non-native person I know. And he's like, I still can't tell. You can't tell. You have to be like that native speaker to know if it sounds good.
Yeah, have a little bit of humility. It's a foreign culture. You're learning about it. So let the native speakers tell you. And that does mean that it's going to take longer to figure out a name that you like and Chinese people can accept. But hey, it's all part of the process.
It is. And you too can find a Chinese name. One is out there just waiting for you. It's waiting in the wings for you to discover it, unearth it, and when you finally scrawl it across the top of your paper, it will shine like a diamond.
Oh, but one other thing. It is an option to not have a Chinese name. Here, I'd like to give a shout out to my friend Brandon O'Kane, and his Chinese name is He Bi. And to someone who doesn't really know Chinese, they might think, oh, okay, he has a Chinese name. Sounds fine. Sure. Doesn't sound like his name too much, but whatever. But the funny thing is, his name is a pun, He Bi. So He Bi kind of means something like, what is the need? Why is there a need? So he chose a name that purposely sounded like that word, meaning like, why do I have to have a Chinese name? That's a pretty cool name. I like it.
If you want to be really adventurous or you want to be a little bit sarcastic, you know, you can pick your name like Xiangjiao or Pingguo, you know, because, you know, those people that choose their name like, oh, I like bananas. So am I going to say my name's Banana?
So you might get, you know, the nickname type name and Chinese people think it's funny and call you that. Oh, one other thing that I think is kind of cool that I've seen a couple times is I know a couple people, like, say there's a guy named Joe Thompson or something. He might choose a Chinese name that rather than reflecting Thompson as his surname, he chooses the Chinese surname Zhou. So it sounds like his first name. And then the Chinese given name sounds like his last name. So you can mess around with it. And, you know, Chinese people aren't going to care. If it sounds like a Chinese name, they're not going to tell you that it's a bad name. But you can play with it that way if you want to.
And now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion.
Okay, and today we are talking about the traditional character versions of Breakthrough, which were just released this last week. So by the time this podcast is published, it was just the week before we launched these traditional versions. We've been getting so many emails about these. Now, comparatively to people who are learning simplified characters, there's not as many people learning traditional, but hey, we care about everyone who's learning Chinese, period. So we do feel it's really important to have these traditional character versions out. And so if you have been learning traditional characters, you can now get the entire Breakthrough level, all five of the books. They're now available in traditional characters.
Yeah, one of the reasons this took so long is that it's harder to convert from simplified to traditional. And there are a lot of possible mistakes that can be made. And so over the course of our company's history, we've gotten better and better at this. And our system is getting smarter and smarter. So if we take a little of extra time with each conversion, we ensure that they're going to be better and better, not just these books, but books going forward, because we want our traditional character learners to have the best possible learning materials out there.
You know, I got to say, John, I never studied any traditional characters, but simply because of doing Mandarin Companion and working with these Breakthrough level books, I've actually learned quite a few.
One of the things that I find kind of interesting is that some of the book titles, book characters, and even whole sections of books are the same in traditional and simplified. And makes me imagine that it would be a fun challenge to try to write a book which is the same in traditional and simplified.
Amen.
Could be done, Jared.
So you can go out and get them today. You can find them on Amazon, iBooks, or Kobo. And you can get the print books are also available on Amazon. So or just go out there and you can find them.
Books. Jared, how can they be sure that the book they've found is the traditional character version? I know some people have been confused about that.
Oh, yes. So on the cover, if you pay attention, look on the cover, there is a red bar that says Traditional Character Edition. And in the book description on any of the websites where you buy it, it says like asterisk Traditional Character Edition, Traditional Chinese Edition. So you can make sure that it is traditional.
So if you don't see the words traditional characters anywhere on the title or in the description, that is not the version you're looking for if you're trying to buy traditional characters.
These aren't the droids you're looking for. Okay, now it's time for Rants and Raves. John, what do you got for us today? You got a rant or a rave?
I have a rant, Jared. It's kind of a weird rant, but it's a rant.
Ooh. Lay it on me.
I often tell people that I don't suffer from culture shock that much. But if there's one way that I do suffer from culture shock, and I am still suffering from culture shock after all these years, it is that I am really not a fan of the Chinese holiday date adjustment method. So I don't want to get into this too much, but the idea is we'll give you a 5-day holiday, but really it's only 3 days. So those other 2 days, we're going to pull them off for the weekend. One Sunday before the holiday and one Saturday following the holiday, you have to go to work because we're moving that holiday to squish it into the 5-day holiday.
Yeah,
as an American, I feel like, weekends are our God-given right. You know, our Sundays are the Lord's Day, the day of rest, and governments cannot take that away, you know, for a lot of jobs. But, you know, in China, it's not like that at all. Very different cultural situation. And we're about to head into the 5-day May holiday, and it just gets me every time.
So to give you an idea, guys, what this really means is that, let's say for the holiday, they give you Thursday and Friday off, and then also the next Monday, so you get like this 5-day weekend. Well, what happens is the very next weekend, you'll have to come work on Saturday. Well, probably for the next 2 weekends, right? You'll have to work on Saturday or Sunday to make up for the holiday that you got off the week before.
Usually it's a 1 weekend day before the holiday and 1 weekend day after it. So you get a 1-day weekend before and after the holiday.
I totally hate that. Like, you got to work this Sunday. I'm like, I don't work on Sundays. Or it's a working Saturday. I'm like, I don't want to work on Saturday.
And I feel like those days that you have to work when you don't normally work are definitely less productive.
Oh, amen. Nobody wants to be there.
But I feel like my Chinese coworkers never complain. They're just like, oh, yeah, this is normal. I really wonder if this system is going to keep going on forever because it's relatively new. All right. Anyway, your turn, Jared.
All right. I have got a rant also. So this is really negative. Holy cow. Yeah, whatever. Here we go. So my rant is when I talk to a lot of teachers, I talk to a lot of learners, and they're always asking for advice, and I'm always telling them about extensive reading. A lot of people are preparing for the test, you know, like HSK or just their class test or AP test. And here's the common thing I hear is like, I don't have time to read. I have to study for the test. Oh, that grinds my gears. Because I've even spent like, you know, 15, 20 minutes talking to someone, explaining extensive reading about the impact improvement you can make with reading in Chinese. And then they're like, oh, well, that's great, but I don't have time to read. I've got to study for the test. I'm like, did you just listen to anything I just said? I'm like, am I just like talking to the wall? Really, guys, it's like if you're studying for the test, one of the best things you can do is build your reading speed. The correlation between reading speed and test success, I mean, it's there. You know, some people argue, well, correlation doesn't indicate causation. Well, I tell you what, that if you can read quickly and fluently on the test, your chances of passing are going to be pretty dang good. So you do need to study. But once again, remember, guys, just by like reading a book about guitar doesn't mean you're going to be able to now play guitar. You're going to have to practice. And if you don't have anyone to practice with, or you need a lot of input, input helps like solidify the Chinese and the language inside your head. Well, reading can be a very effective way, and it's one of the most effective ways to do that. It's controlled at your own level, and it's going to really help you boost your fluency skills and pass that test. So, yeah, don't be that guy. Don't be the, I don't have time to read. I have to study for the test, because if that's where you're at, you're probably not going to pass.
This actually reminds me of an issue I run into a lot at All Set Learning, because what we do is helping people become fluent speakers of Mandarin. And so some people are like, well, I want to work on passing the HSK-5, so can you help me with that? And my response is, well, if you want to just pass the HSK, then take an HSK prep course. Like, if you want to pass a test, you study for the test. If you want to get fluent in Chinese, well, we're here, but you got to kind of choose what you're trying to do here.
Yeah, there's that one interview I had on one of our podcasts, Matthew Armstrong. It's in episode 24. It's the 4 types of tone mistakes. But Matthew, he talks about how he passed the HSK-5, but he's like, but I wasn't really HSK-5. He's like, and I'm definitely not HSK-5 today. So it was actually a very refreshing perspective. It's like, just because you passed the test doesn't mean you're proficient.
Exactly. The test has their own standard.
So John, when are you going to take the HSK-6?
I took the HSK back in the day.
HSK what?
It was the HSK-8.
Eight? Oh my gosh. That's like beyond fluent.
That was a different scale. So I got the level I needed to get into graduate school in Chinese and got my master's. So don't think I'll be revisiting the HSK. But of course, I look at the HSK stuff all the time, because even though we don't do test prep, we do use it as a reference for some of our clients.
I want an easy win, John. I'm going to go take the HSK-1 and I'm going to nail it.
All right. You have fun with that.
I'm from England. I'm from the Midlands.
Millie Potter is from a small village in the UK called Crick. She is a young, fresh-eyed, and determined recent university graduate.
Liverpool University has a lot of Chinese students. I think there's about 3,000 come just from the partner university alone.
Wow.
And I just thought it'd be good to study abroad, and China was where I went.
At times, we may enroll in a program with a prescribed path others have trod. However, due to sheer force of will, Millie insisted upon pursuing enhanced opportunities that lay off the beaten path.
And I could have gone somewhere in Europe, or I could have gone to America or Australia, but I just thought, if I'm going to take the commitment to study abroad, I might as well go somewhere that's completely different, to really throw myself in at the deep end. So I went to China.
Which opened her up to experiences she otherwise never could have had. Stay with us. So how did you get this all hooked up then? So you say, hey, I want to go to China. I want to go study abroad. And I guess you have the sister university. And what university was that?
So it's Xi'an Jiao Tong Liverpool University. It's obviously a partnership between Xi'an Jiao Tong University and Liverpool University, but it's in Suzhou. It's not in Xi'an.
Oh, wow. Okay. So there's all sorts of curveballs there.
Yeah.
All right. So you got the opportunity to go to Suzhou. Now, how did this all come about then? So you apply for the program, or you just said, hey, I want to go?
So I had to apply, but because it's a sister university, it's like a partner, I think the spaces were unlimited. It was basically as long as you get the grades, you'll get to go.
So how did you feel about this? You had the opportunity to go to China. I mean, what was going through your head?
I'd never been to China, and I'd only learned sort of very, very basic Chinese at the time. Just a friend had, you know, taught me some numbers and how to say like my name and how much is this. So I was nervous. I didn't know anyone else really that was going. I just knew the one person. We weren't friends as such. We just were acquaintances. But before I went, I'd spoken to like the study abroad staff at my university, and they were very reassuring. You know, they said lots of people go and they don't know anyone and it's fine. You'll make friends there. When we got there, we get put in accommodation, which is all international students. None of them are Chinese. And obviously everyone at this university speaks English because all the classes are taught in English.
This is a common thing I do hear about people sometimes, like in your situation, they go to China to learn Chinese, but you end up in these environments with all English speakers and, you know, the classes are all in English. So what did you do? Like, how did you start really making some progress in learning Chinese?
So I decided if I was going to go to China, I was going to learn the language. I didn't want to just go and be the kind of, you know, the expat that never bothers to learn. So I signed up for the intensive classes, and I did that before I ever went, and I was absolutely determined because, I mean, the university had initially said to us, the Liverpool students can't choose intensive classes. We have a special module for Liverpool students. It's like a basic Chinese one. You don't learn characters, you just use pinyin. And I emailed the universities and I said, I don't want to do that. If I'm going to go to China, I want to learn Chinese, proper Chinese. And I basically begged and begged and begged, and so did a few other students, apparently, until they changed their mind and said, we could choose intensive classes. So that was, I think, 10 hours a week. It was 8 hours in sort of small groups, like a regular class. And then we had like an hour, it was almost like a review class, which was slightly bigger because all the groups came together for that. And then another hour, we could have one-on-one with the teacher. It was a good way to learn, I think. It was very intense. It was difficult. We always had so much homework, but it was good.
Well, Millie, I really admire what you've done here, but I also want to know, like, what was that motivation for you? I mean, it would have been so easy to just say, all right, you know, they're giving us Chinese classes. Maybe it's not intensive, but I'll just go try to, you know, learn everything I can. And, oh, pinyin's good enough, I guess. But why did you feel the need to just say, hey, really, I don't know, I really got to get into this?
I think everyone kind of is like, oh, I like learning about other cultures, but I didn't want to live somewhere and not be able to communicate with the locals at all. So I thought, if I'm going to be there for a year, I'm going to do my absolute best to learn as much as I can, be as fluent as possible in the time that I've got.
I mean, obviously, when you got there, you can understand very little. So can you think of some times where you really started making some progress, or you felt you made some breakthroughs, or you were able to make connections with people using your Chinese?
It was the really little things, like being able to understand like the store assistants or the people selling street food, being able to ask like, oh, what's that? And to understand what they said back, and just that kind of feeling of like, yeah, I've got this. Like, I don't speak perfectly and I don't understand everything, but it was that kind of feeling of I can communicate, I can make myself understood, and I can understand other people. It was like motivation to keep on improving. It was almost like just a feeling of success. Like, I've done it. I've managed to learn all this.
Those are some cool experiences.
I mean, one time I accidentally left my phone on the counter in a shop, and the assistant came running out after me. Like, I hadn't realized that I'd left my phone, but I understood what they were saying before they got to me. Like, you've left your phone, you've left your phone. And I was just like amazed at myself. I could understand it because, you know, they had a bit of an accent and I was just so proud of myself.
I love that. Those are like small wins that make a big difference,
yeah,
right?
Just a really little thing, but it made me just feel like I'd achieved so much and be able to understand what was going on.
Achievement unlocked.
Yes.
And especially when they have an accent too, and you're like, I actually understood that. That was a pretty thick accent, but yeah, I know what
that guy said. Yeah, the accent thing was, because obviously I was learning in Suzhou near Shanghai. It's a very kind of standard accent. It's like halfway up the country. It's not northern or southern. And then I stayed with a host family in Beijing during my breaks, so Chinese New Year and also in the summer. And when I first went to Beijing and I was with the family, my host mom was like, Kaimer, Kaimer. And I had no idea what she was saying because I'd never heard the accent. I was so confused to start with.
For those who don't speak Beijing Hua, that is Kaimen, you know, open the door.
Yeah, it was really strange. And it took me so long to kind of get to grips with putting the R kind of on everything.
The R Hua. That still throws me off. I'm a little more used to it now, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, it was really, really odd at first. And I think by the time I then went back to Suzhou after the Chinese New Year, I'd picked up a bit of a Beijing accent, and it was quite weird not hearing it all the time.
So I want to hear about this a little bit. Like, how did you get this all arranged to go stay with a host family? I know a lot of people don't get that opportunity. So like, how did that get arranged, and what was that experience like?
It was a very, very informal arrangement. I went on to some au pairing websites, put in, you know, the settings. I'm looking for a family in China. And I just searched through a few families. I spoke to a few families until I found one that I kind of clicked well with. And I arranged a Skype call with them, which was in August, just before I left for China. I was already decided at that point that if I was going to learn Chinese, I was going to do it properly. So I had a Skype call with them in August, and it was with the host family and with a friend of theirs. She speaks fluent English. And so we had a bit of a discussion about what the expectations would be. I would teach their kid English for like a couple of hours a day, and they would help me with Chinese. And there was no contract or anything. I remember when I got on the train in January, I was texting my friends being like, I've only spoken to these people like properly on Skype once. So if I don't contact you by like 10 o'clock, can you please call the police and assume I'm dead or something? Because I hadn't really stayed in touch with them very much. And I was just kind of hoping that they were nice. And they were. So I got very lucky. And there were a couple of other families actually in the same community that had au pairs. And they had au pairs for like 6 months, as opposed to just me being there for a month in winter and 2 months in summer.
So tell me about that experience, and how did your Chinese improve during that time?
So in the winter, every morning, my host kid would go to an English class for 2 hours. And in those 2 hours, my host mom would sit with me and read the books I'd got, which were Mandarin companion books.
I've heard of those books. Yes, they're fantastic.
They were actually really, really good. Yeah, they were so helpful. So we'd read them together, and she was very, I think strict makes it sound kind of almost cruel, but she was very strict in trying to make sure that I was saying everything right. I was getting all my tones right, all that kind of thing. So we would read it together. Like I would read it first and then she'd read it and then I'd have to copy her. And we'd just go over and over the same sentences and the same chapters over and over again until I got it perfect. It was really kind of draining, like the energy it took to stay focused and everything, but it was so useful. And I left and my pronunciation was a million times better than when I arrived.
Wow. Well, that's the impact of deliberate practice and focus.
Yes.
And that's what it takes sometimes.
And I think that kind of immersion, obviously being with a family, it's so different to being in a classroom setting where everyone can speak English. Not that the classroom was bad. I mean, I learned a lot. My teacher was great. But being with a family where you have to speak Chinese to be understood, it really sort of forces your brain into that setting of thinking in Chinese. And very occasionally I'll think in Chinese now, like the really, really basic things. Someone's like, oh, do you have this and that? And in my head, I'm like, mayo. Like just the really, really basic kind of almost like the immediate responses that you would say.
I still want to reply to people, you know, 可以, you know.
Yeah.
You know, 不知道, you know, or something like that. But you're like,
I say that
Chinese
all the time. Yeah. I'm like, my parents will ask me something and I'll be like, 不知道, and they'll be like, what? They should have learned this by now because I say it all the time.
I also want to hear a little bit about this. You said the host mother, she sat with you and read the Mandarin Companion books. You said it was really kind of taxing. Now, even at the end, did you still kind of feel that taxing or did you get a little more used to it over time?
No. I mean, at the start, it was like within 5 minutes, I was almost getting a headache from that intense focus. And by the end of the month, it was still work. It was still hard. But it was nowhere near as difficult as when I started. I think as well, it was just sort of my confidence. When I first got there, I was really worried about making mistakes. And I knew that I'd be making mistakes because I knew that, you know, my accent wasn't very good and I got my tones wrong sometimes. And by the end, I just was in that kind of headspace of, if I make a mistake, they'll correct me and it's not a problem. And so actually, I think having that kind of confidence to speak and not really caring if I was a little bit wrong meant that I spoke so much more and I improved so much. It was only a month that I was there the first time. And within that month, I felt like I improved so much.
Well, that sounds like you had the opportunity to generate a lot of output. And that's one of the things that really helped you.
Yeah, it was really good.
The thing is, it's like it's having a safe environment because sometimes it's hard. Like not everyone feels comfortable just going out on the street and talking.
Because obviously I was living in their house. It was very much a family feeling. In the first couple of days, obviously it's a bit odd trying to get used to a new place and the really hard mattresses that seemingly every family in China has.
Permanent backache.
Yeah, like sleeping on a rock. So, but after a few days when I'd settled in, it was a really comfortable environment. And it was something that I don't think you can ever really get with speaking to people in shops because you never really get a long conversation anyway with someone in a shop.
But this also highlights something I think is important. And I talk to students and teachers about this. And it's about like building endurance, if you will, like in Chinese and getting able to like have longer conversations. And this is really important, especially for people who are like trying to prepare for tests. You know, and I say, hey, you're going to sit for the HSK test or AP Chinese or something like that. Or, you know, you've got the GCSE test in Chinese. I'm like, this is like hours long tests. And I'm like, have you ever sat down and ever had a half hour conversation in Chinese? Most people are like, no. And so it's like, how can you expect to do well on a 2-3 hour Chinese test when you've never immersed yourself at least for a couple hours in Chinese?
Yeah, I definitely do think that if you're only ever learning in like 5 or 10 minute chunks, I mean, it's better than nothing, but you never really go into like a fully kind of Chinese brain mode. And so I know that having the longer classes was definitely useful. We always used to get like a 10-minute break halfway to sort of refill water bottles or whatever. And it was almost like just such a relief when the break came, because my brain was in overdrive. And I think it was the same for everyone, because especially towards the start, when you're new to learning a language and all of a sudden you're doing 2-hour classes every single day, it's really, really mentally tiring. Mm-hmm. But I think the best way to learn is real intensity, because yes, it's tiring. I felt exhausted all the time. I was constantly working. I think I did more work in my year abroad than I'd done in my years before that, even though it didn't actually count towards my degree grade. It didn't count at all. But it was something that I just wanted to learn. It was something that was genuinely interesting to me. Yeah, it was very, very, very intense, but absolutely worth it.
Well, what happened next? So you went and did the homestay with this family, but you only had 1 year in the program. So like, what did you do to continue to learn Chinese? And I know you were in China still for a little while after that.
So I did the homestay over Chinese New Year, so January to February. And then I went back to Suzhou for my second semester. And at the end of my second semester, I'd made friends that lived in Taiwan and South Korea. So I just traveled to visit them. And then I went back and I packed my bags and I got on a train up to Beijing again. And this time I stayed with, so it wasn't the same family, but it was like my host mother's sister. So I'd met the family before. And it was just that her son, so like the kid that I was originally with, cousin, I don't know, we clicked better. And he absolutely adored me. And I'm not sure why, because the other kid did not. The girl that I was with over winter, I didn't dislike her and she didn't dislike me. It just wasn't a sort of natural connection. Whereas her cousin, Eric, we just got on really, really well. He was a year younger, I guess more sort of playful, more childlike. Joy, the kid that I was with in winter, was quite, she was almost just like a teenager in the body of an 8-year-old, a bit more sort of moody. And
I've got an 8-year-old that's like that sometimes.
Yeah. Whereas Eric was just a lot more playful, a lot more like a child. And he would follow me everywhere. He'd try and follow me into the toilet. I'd be like, I just need 5 minutes, please. He just wanted to be around me all the time. And it was sweet.
Well, Millie, tell me what it was like living with a Chinese family.
There were certain things, especially at the start, that I found really odd. Like the kitchens were so small, and that was,
oh yes,
I found that really weird.
It's like the size of a closet, you know?
Yeah. And also like the showers, there's no sort of like separate shower cubicle in their houses. I found it really confusing because I'd obviously lived in this international student accommodation. Everything had been built in a very Western style. We had, you know, a shower curtain to separate the shower from the rest of the bathroom. And in these houses, they didn't have that. And I was just like, there's going to be water going everywhere. The water's going to go all over the toilet seat. It was fine, but just
take a shower while you're sitting on the toilet.
Yeah, it was weird.
Now, those are some things about like the apartment and the homes that they were living in. But like, what was different, like in just like kind of the family dynamics and maybe things that you weren't used to that maybe the family did?
So the family that I was with in the winter, the dad in that family, he worked away all week. He worked, I think, in Inner Mongolia. He worked on some sort of like solar panel farm almost. Like he worked for an energy company. Monday mornings, like 4 or 5 a.m., he'd leave. And he wouldn't come back until Friday night. And so he'd only be at home at the weekends. I know that that's not rare in other places, but I found that dynamic quite strange. Because it was, they didn't even have phone calls, sort of, maybe once during the week. And I can't imagine being like an 8-year-old and not ever seeing one of my parents.
Yeah, sometimes the dynamics are not what we're used to in the West.
Yeah. Another thing that really kind of threw me was that these kids, even at the age of like 7 and 8, still slept in their parents' beds. And they had their own bedrooms and they just didn't sleep in them yet.
Interesting.
Yeah. In the West, by the time that you're 2 years old, you normally are sleeping in a separate room from your parents.
Well, what about some of the foods that they would eat, or just, you know, maybe any traditions you found that were just different?
So I'd gotten used to eating a lot of rice when I was in Suzhou, like just boiled rice with almost everything. And my host family ate a lot of noodles. And that actually, I found it a little bit weird to start with, because They were really big fans of like noodle soups. And I'm not a big fan of soups. I find Chinese soups, they're too watery almost. And also my family were originally from Baoji, so near Xi'an. So they like spicy food and they would put spicy oil, spicy seasoning on everything. And I had to just say, like, I cannot handle it. you know, I'm a white girl, I'm from the UK, like I've never really had anything anywhere near that spicy. I just could not manage like the kind of food that they ate. And I think as well, the snacks, I'd been eating like some biscuits and some crisps and I had fruits, and all of a sudden I'm eating the kind of things that they're eating, and it's just like dried dates I'd never had before. It was just different. Everything was different. And for my birthday, they had someone make me a cake, which was very, very nice. And we'd been in their hometown before my birthday. My 21st birthday, I woke up on a sleeper train. That was a very interesting experience, because obviously my family are trying to be nice and be like, happy birthday. And there's all these strangers in the bunks around us, just kind of staring. Mm-hmm. But then we got back to their apartment. Someone had made a cake and they brought it to me. It was not like any cake I'd ever seen before.
I know like, what you're in talking the West, about.
Like, it was like they put all this kind of whipped cream on it.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is this? I was just, it was confusing. And I really, really appreciated the effort, because I know that they don't really eat Western food. And so it was very odd, but I really did appreciate the effort they'd put into it.
Yeah. No, that is nice. My other life, I have a bakery in Shanghai, and I've run into this issue a lot of times. I call a lot of these cakes. They look very pretty. You know, they look really nice. Looks like, hey, this is going to taste really great. And you eat it and it's just lacking flavor, right? It's just.
Yeah. It's like.
I call it kongbao, which is, you know, empty bread or something.
Yeah, so. Definitely. I just found it so strange. I was like, it's not even sweet. It's almost just like nothing. It just tasted of.
Yeah, it's
nothing.
It's like nothing. I mean, it looks great, doesn't it? It has some fruit
they're
on
they're
it.
They're absolutely beautiful, these cakes.
Well, I want to hear, Millie, like, how has Chinese impacted your life?
Even coming back to the UK, I'll occasionally see things written in Chinese, and it can be anywhere, you know, walking past like a Chinese restaurant and being able to understand it. And it just feels almost like a little reminder of an achievement in learning. I think learning a language, any language, is good. We all know it's good for your brain to learn another language. It kind of gives me this confidence, I think. Even though I'm not fluent, I'm nowhere near fluent, being able to understand things does make me feel like it's a real achievement. Like I understand more of the world and more of the people around me. And I feel like being able to communicate with someone in their own language is a very different feeling to them accommodating you.
There's a quote I like. It's along these same lines. It says, you know, to speak a second language is to possess a second soul. It opens up your worldview quite a bit.
And I think as well, Chinese is a very interesting language as a native English speaker. I'd learned other European languages, and it's almost like you're learning just sort of individual words and you just swap them around and maybe a slightly different word order. But the language is structured very similarly to English. Whereas with Chinese, it's so, so different. The whole way that the language is constructed, the way that words put together. I follow a few sort of Chinese learning pages on Instagram so that when I'm scrolling through, at least I'm learning something. And I saw Kohong, and I just thought that makes so much sense for the word lipstick to literally just be mouth red. And I thought, you know, I think it makes me sort of realize more about English as well, because obviously that same word in English, lipstick, is these two words put together in a very kind of logical way. And it was something that I'd never really noticed before. And it's much more common in Chinese, obviously, because with characters, you're a lot more limited. You can't make up new words like people do in English. I found it really interesting the way that words are constructed, and you can sort of tell a meaning sometimes from the characters. Even if you haven't seen a word before, you can work out what it means from knowing what the individual characters in it mean. You could never do that with English. If you don't know a word, you don't know it. Whereas mm-hmm. in Chinese, being able to work things out, it's almost like a puzzle sometimes. I'm doing now that I'm back in the UK and now that all the universities have closed down, I'm in part of a group for like a language exchange. And these Chinese students, that bless them, they've been so lovely. They've been like preparing worksheets for us each week. And they've been sort of trying to teach us certain phrases, like slang and that kind of thing that we didn't know. We got taught this week, bao da tui, it literally is like to hug a big leg, but they taught us the phrase as it's sort of like latching onto someone who's got sort of more power than you, you know, latching onto someone to try and get ahead. And I just thought that was, it's quite a nice phrase really. And they taught us tai niao. It's a really cute word for, say, like a beginner's, like a vegetable bird. It just is really cute. I just, being able to sort of understand how people think in a culture.
Well, Millie, going through the experience you did and learning Chinese, what do you think you would do differently if you were to do it over again?
Because I lived with entirely international students, I spent most of my time with international students speaking English. I think if there was one thing that I could change, it would be I would have joined some of the societies at the university and I would have gone and tried to speak in Chinese to the other students more often. Because actually, when I wasn't in class, when I was at the university, I didn't speak an awful lot of Chinese around the campus. I would speak in class and I would speak if I was ordering food or something, I would speak a little bit, or if I was getting a delivery. But most of the time, I was still speaking in English and I would have just wanted to push myself out there a bit more, out of my comfort zone, spend more time with Chinese people speaking Chinese from the start.
That's good advice. That's always the challenge, right?
It's scary. It's really scary. The fear of sort of making mistakes and looking like an idiot, I think it's huge. I was so scared that, you know, I'd make a mistake and someone would think I was really stupid and that kind of thing. And I think now that I've learned a bit more, I have a lot more confidence. But, you know, I look back and I think, well, people would have known I was a beginner. You know, I wouldn't judge someone for making a mistake in English. They're not going to judge me for making a mistake in Chinese. And I wish I had that mindset sooner.
That's a really good point. You know, it's like we mature in life and we realize we just got to get out there and get stupid and make mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't learn if you don't make mistakes, right?
Exactly. Well, Millie, I think this has been really insightful. I really appreciate you taking the time to share this experience with us, and I really valued this. So thanks for sharing this.
Yeah, thank you.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, rollerblader, bike rider, rainbow chaser, tree climber, pasta lover, beach bum, and that one guy named Joe. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mandarincompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is James Harper. I'd like to thank our guest, Millie Potter, and I'd like to thank my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pazin. See you next time.